Hello and welcome to the Beyond Biotech podcast number 89. I'm Jim Cornall and this is the weekly podcast from LaBiotech. And we have a fascinating subject for you this week. I'm sure most people have heard about Colossal Biosciences, and if not the company, at least what they're working on. There have been many headlines based around the company's plans to bring back woolly mammoths, dodos, and thylacines, otherwise known as the Tasmanian tiger. The US company is also at the forefront of critically endangered species protection and the repopulation of critical ecosystems. We had a great conversation with Ben Lam, co-founder and CEO of Colossal Biosciences, about the company's plans.
I guess before we get to the company and the plans that you have, I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about your own background, because that also seems kind of interesting.
Yeah, so my background has been mostly in technology. I'm new to synthetic biology and biotech, and my kind of, I guess, superpower has always been working with much smarter women and men than me to build teams and kind of set a vision. So I've worked in everything from gaming to artificial intelligence before it was as sexy as it is today, to satellite software and hardware design for space in the sector of mostly in defense and critical infrastructure. And then I had one of the first conversational OSs back before people were calling things large language models. So worked in a myriad of different technology, mostly software initiatives. And then I met George Church, who rapidly changed the course of my life. I called him to reach out to talk about the applications to software for synthetic biology, so I thought that could be my next area of interest. I'm a curious person, so I did ask the question, George, if you had unlimited capital in one project that you would have to focus the rest of your life on, what would it be and why? And he said I would bring back the woolly mammoth, reintroduce it back into the Arctic, as well as build systems that could be applied to both human healthcare and to conservation to save critically endangered species. It's a very eye-opening moment for me, because as an entrepreneur, I've always thought about building companies that had material impact, but actually something that could be this transformative and this impactful, or something that was, you know, just really, really interesting.
For sure. I guess that segues nicely into the formation of Colossal Biosciences. So could you tell me about how that started?
Yeah. So I, at the time, was running a defense and satellite software company called Hypergiant. We were focused on cloud-based command and control, leveraging AI for mostly U.S. Air Force and Space Force. And, you know, really enjoyed building that. And you know, we had a couple hundred people building this pretty cool defense and critical infrastructure space company. As I mentioned, met George and decided that I've said 1,000 times in meetings and I'm building this company to have a massive impact and change the world. And now George Church put this opportunity on my plate that could be really impactful. And, you know, if we were successful in our endeavors, which we hope to be, we will change the world. And so I felt like I was going to be the biggest hypocrite ever if we didn't at least attempt this and go after it. So we decided to do this in late 2019. There was a small pandemic that occurred that kind of slowed things down, but I brought in a new CEO to replace me at my last company and started raising capital for, at that time, a de-extinction and species preservation company when nobody had ever built a for-profit species preservation company or a de-extinction company. So it was definitely a unique pitch to investors.
I wonder if you could explain a little bit about the techniques that you'll be using with respect to de-extinction.
Yeah, and I am not, what I'll say is, you know, while I'm a quick study, I'm not a scientist, and I try to hire much smarter. I think my superpower is hiring much smarter people than I am in these categories. But I have learned quite a bit in the last few years since doing this, because it's just so fascinating. And I truly believe that outside of de-extinction species preservation, the world of synthetic biology and kind of the integration of compute and automation and AI will really change science more towards engineering, which I'm just fascinated with that concept as a whole is being able to engineer life and make these fundamental changes and whatnot. So a little bit about the process is, you know, we're not trying to synthesize full genomes. There is some DNA synthesis in what we're doing. There's single nucleotide editing. There's multiplex editing where we're editing multiple parts all over the genome. And then, you know, the DNA synthesis and large cargo swaps is something that we're getting much, much better at. And we looked at the problem first as a software problem. And, you know, we, and part of our thesis with Colossal is on the path to building out de-extinction. While we will build some technologies for conservation, we'll also build some technologies for human healthcare. And in that, we will try to monetize those companies if we feel there's the right product market fit. And so our first company that ended up coming out of Colossal was called Form Bio. And it was because when we started to look at all of the ancient DNA assembly that was needed, all of the guide design that we wanted to do for all of our editing tools, as well as improving the pipelines for ancient DNA, which is a different, slightly different process than just non-ancient and massively degraded DNA. And then doing the computational analysis to start to understand, you know, the differences between the closest living relatives to our extinct species that we're working on and starting to map genotype to phenotype expressions. So we saw there being a large need for computational analysis in the workflows that we were starting to attempt. And so, you know, given that the editing and the cell lines can be very precious and time consuming, the better we could approach the problem from an automation and AI perspective and a data perspective was key. So we probably over-indexed on data in terms of like the number of sequences we've done, the all the comparative genomics that we've done to try to make us better. But once we get to this first set of edits that we start doing, you know, as I mentioned, we're using a combination of these different editing tools that we do in somatic cells. And, you know, based on improving the efficiencies and whatnot, we have different types of processes that we're putting in place to test both molecular and functional assays. You know, iPSC, induced pluripotent stem cell work, is a big focus across the various species that we're working on in our mammalian work. We are working to try to also cultivate primordial germ cells in the right media conditions for that in our avian work. And then once, you know, we are successful in these processes and the editing and getting the editing efficiencies and all the edits in that we want, and we've done the right level of testings through kind of the different, hopefully different tissue type derivation from stem cells, you know, then we go through a somatic cell nuclear transfer process to transfer the nucleus into an egg cell and then into surrogacy. And so that's kind of the core workflow that we have at Colossal, at least at its highest level. And then we separately have a 17-person team, which just feels like a lot of science fiction, which is focused on the ex utero development or artificial wombs. And so we've got everything from, you know, people working on hardware devices to doing uterine flushes to understanding all of the different chemical transponders that occur at different stages of development of some of our model and non-model species. And then we even are working on this kind of decidualized endometrial layer that's synthetic. So we're looking to, you know, we have lots of different kind of shots on goal on how we're approaching this. We call it a placental interface, but most people just call it some form of a uterine wall. We have a lot of different pretty deep science initiatives at Colossal, but we try to look at all from an engineering and systems point of view so that we're not just trying to create individual point solutions, but build scalable systems that can work across species and then across like family groups as well.
It's a big project and there must be quite a lot of challenges. I wonder if you could outline some of the biggest challenges and how you're tackling those.
Yeah, so I mean, one is, you know, anytime you start putting a lot of edits into cells, you have cellular health issues, right? So we spend a lot of time ensuring that like our immortalization constructs and all of the media that we're putting together is really optimized for this. You know, we're working a lot of non-model species, right? Like, you know, there's not exactly a playbook to work with elephants. There's not a playbook to work with fat-tailed dunharts in marsupials, right? So we are working in these very interesting non-model species. So we have to optimize so much of the process for each one of these species. So cellular health is one that, you know, we've had to spend a lot of time on to ensure that we can get the right number of edits. Another area of challenge, but we see it as a real opportunity, is in both DNA synthesis and multiplex editing. And so we can't share any exact numbers, but I will say that from what we've seen in peer-reviewed literature, we have vastly surpassed what we've seen out there from a multiplex editing perspective. So being able to make multiple edits all over the genome that are, you know, not just linear repeats or, you know, knockouts, these are a series of different types of edits. And so, you know, we think that has massive application to disease state, attacking different types of disease states in humans and in animals. And so that's an area of challenge. You know, I'd say one of our kind of the themes you'll probably notice with Colossal is that we're not doing any of this work in a linear fashion. That would just add a decade to the work. We're trying to parallel path. That's why we have so many people. That's why we've raised so much capital. And so we have entire embryology teams that are trying to increase everything from like cloning efficiencies in model and non-model organisms to leveraging computer-aided and robotic-assisted somatic cellular transfer, to looking to also optimize kind of what our throughput rate could be on editing cells and then getting those cells into embryos and trying to optimize that as well. So we're interesting because while we're looking at the entire system problem, we're tackling each one of those components of it in parallel. So we're not waiting till we have edited Asian elephant cells to then go work on somatic cell nuclear transfer and kind of crack the embryology side, right? So we are working on a lot of different things that we think are pretty interesting in each one of these categories, which we think could give rise to different businesses and other applications for conservation. And so one of the things that, you know, I'd say kind of the biggest opportunity and, you know, biggest engineering challenge is that ex utero development team, right? It's if we can really crack the code on that, not only will it allow us to make more potential species that surrogacy is not currently an option for, or as well as more of them, so that you're not leveraging animals, you're leveraging ex utero development systems. And then also, we think it'll be a game changer for conservation. If we have the ability to grow, you know, 50 northern white rhinos ex utero in warehouses and labs, and then work with, you know, tier one conservation and rewilding partners, put the animals back into their natural habitat, we think that's really interesting. And so kind of this fusion of synthetic biology with conservation is something that we think is absolutely needed given the current biodiversity crisis that exists. And I naively came into this category, you know, I was just thinking that every species, a reference genome had been built because we have the tools and technologies. I was very shocked that we don't have all of the tools needed for some of this. And I was very shocked that all of the genetic sequences, you know, for, you know, just like we have with like the seed vault, don't exist in all animals. So I felt like once again, it was another opportunity for us to kind of start pushing, building reference genomes for some of these non-model organisms.
What kind of things do you need in order to be able to build, I guess, a species that was extinct? Do you need genetic material and a similar species that's currently alive?
Yeah, so we build a reference genome for its closest living relative. So like in the case of the mammoth, that's the Asian elephant's closest living relative. Mammoths are actually closer related to Asian elephants than Asian elephants are even to African elephants. So you have to get cells, you have to get samples, you have to build a full reference genome, which we have for the Asian elephant and published it. We've done the same thing for the African elephant. We're working on two other subspecies of elephants right now, more from a conservation perspective than really a mammoth perspective. And then the ancient DNA is highly fragmented. There's so much degradation that occurs in things, obviously, after they die. And so our best samples come from cold, dry places, as you may guess. And, you know, we get samples. We're now working with over 60 mammoth genomes to help us establish several reference genomes that we have been leveraging from our comparative genomics.
One of the other things that springs to mind is the fragility of ecosystems and how complicated they are. How do you take into account those kind of challenges? For example, will the reintroduction of a species that hasn't been around for a long time upset that balance?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. And, you know, we've tried to identify species that there will be a positive ecological impact for each of them. So in the case of the thylacine, you know, it was hunted to extinction by man based on bounties from the Australian government putting them on their head, and it went extinct in 1936. There's been no apex predator that has replaced it in that ecosystem. And as we've seen, like in Yellowstone here in the United States and in other rewilding cases around the world, when you remove an apex predator, the ecosystem changes and it starts to degrade over time. You typically have more older animals living longer. You also have sicker animals kind of breeding in the population. Typically, predators, when they expend energy, they're going after the young, the sick, or the weak, or the old, I guess. And so you see a huge negative effect due to this trophic downgrading that occurs. And so for us, that's why the thylacine makes a lot of sense. With the case of the dodo, which went extinct in the late 1600s, in Mauritius, also due to another human-caused extinction, which is like the symbol of de-extinction or symbol extinction, like reintroducing the dodo doesn't necessarily change the ecosystem, but we're working with Mauritian Wildlife Foundation to clean up the ecosystem there and start to modify the ecosystem and remove some of the invasive species, which is not only helpful for the reintroduction of the dodo, but helps some of the endemic species that are there currently. And so they're almost, the Mauritian government's almost using the dodo as a rallying cry to actually start updating and fixing the ecosystem, which we find really helpful from a conservation perspective, not just of rewilding extinct species like the dodo to Mauritius and the neighboring islands, but also helping those endemic species that live there. And then last, but certainly not least, the mammoth. You know, there's been really interesting ecological modeling that's been done on reintroducing cold-tolerant megafauna back into the Arctic to try to revitalize the mammoth steppe ecosystem. And, you know, while there's varying models from the levels of impact, generally speaking, we actually have a paper in peer review right now talking about, it's our mammoth capacity paper, looking at just generally speaking what the impacts could be and what number of mammoths at what density could be supported today. And so generally speaking, while there's a wide range of impact hypotheses, there's a small consensus that's now growing that the impact from reintroducing mega herbivores that are cold tolerant to that region will increase the nitrogen-oxygen cycling and be beneficial. And so how beneficial is really kind of that small minority that we're still trying to figure out. As I mentioned, there's different models for, you know, different sides, but generally speaking, the scientific community is pretty aligned that there will be a net positive impact. And so I think that we won't probably really understand net positive until we actually have animals in environments, in large, expansive environments that we can monitor and understand, kind of like the work that's been done with forest elephants in Africa and some of the savanna elephants as well. And so we do know that these species all make sense from a de-extinction and a rewilding perspective, but, you know, really looking at the positive impacts of that is only something that we can do and measure over time. But that's why you have to work with indigenous people groups, private landowners, governments, conservation groups, other NGOs, which we are doing. Like actually later today, I've got our quarterly Tasmanian Tiger Working Group. So we have a quarterly meeting with Aboriginal leaders, members from the university, members even from the logging commission in Tasmania, some of the local mayors, some of the private landowners, just to ensure that we are getting their consistent feedback in collaboration.
Obviously, in anything that can be perceived as controversial like this or unrealistic even, you get naysayers. How are you tackling that negativity?
Well, you know, what's interesting is that when you do anything in today's world, especially in the U.S. right now, you're going to get 50% of the people not happy with you. I think that's generally a good rule of thumb. What we've seen, because we do a lot of sentiment analysis and looking at kind of the metrics, we've seen that vast majority of our work trends more positive, either neutral or neutral positive or positive. And so it's actually pretty fascinating to us that we get as much positive feedback as we do, and it does outweigh the negative, you know, just from a sheer metrics perspective. which I find very fascinating, but because it was not what we expected. But on the negative, you know, there's probably some really great feedback and comments there. Now, what's challenging for us is, you know, we've taken a position that, you know, we want to be transparent, we want to be collaborative, and we actually want to listen to what we call informed critics, right? And so for example, Lou Badalan and Beth Shapiro were two of our biggest critics when we launched. Beth Shapiro joined as chief science officer 2 weeks ago, right? 24 months later. And that's because we engaged with Beth, we tried to understand what her feedback was, how we could do it better, what we could learn from it. And then we went and implemented it, right? And I think that that's our general philosophy around informed critics, is to run towards them, not away from them. And I think that that spirit of transparency has led us to have some of the incredible, you know, internationally known scientists on our scientific advisory board, and our collaborators on our conservation teams as well. And so I think you can learn a lot more from an informed critic than you can a non-informed critic. Now, granted, the vast number of naysayers that unfortunately don't fall on the informed critic side, there are folks that don't read our website, don't have a background in conservation or developmental biology or genetics or synthetic biology. And so we do occasionally get the people that are like, this sounds big and weird and bold, you shouldn't do it. But there's not a lot of meat there, right? And then we also get the feedback of, this is impossible. It's like, well, a museum curator that doesn't have a background in genetics or developmental biology probably is not the best informed critic on what's possible from a genetics perspective versus like George Church or Chris Mason, right? So we try to listen to everybody, but we really do try to dial into the informed critics, because many of those critics have helped us shape who we are today. I don't think we would be the company we are today without the negative feedback that we have gotten from some informed critics that have helped shape our company. So we're very grateful to that.
I'm in Scotland, and there are controversies here and arguments about reintroduction of species like wildcats. And these are species that do exist in other countries that are no longer here. Is that something else that you're looking to help with, is the reintroduction of species to places that they're no longer found?
Yeah, I think we will work mostly with third-party partners on that, right? Like today, it's good that we're chatting today. We announced our partnership with Rewild, which is one of the world's leading conservation groups, focuses on searching for lost species, reintroduction of species back into the wild, developing conservation tools and technologies. And we just announced our major partnership today. And so, you know, we will probably most likely lean on our conservation partners for the rewilding aspects of both the extinct species that we bring back, as well as some of the endemic species that we're doing. But it will be one that's very collaborative in nature.
Does that extend to sort of critically endangered species?
That's correct, right? And so, like, we are working as a genetic rescue partner on the Northern White Rhino project, but we're looking to help engineer in genetic diversity from museum samples and other samples from frozen zoos and whatnot all over the world. We are not responsible for reintroducing the future northern white rhinos back into their native habitat. We'd love to be collaborative and partners with the incredible teams at like Rewild and Kenya Wildlife Services and BioRescue, but we are just the genetic rescue and the technology company behind part of that.
Why do you think there's the amount of interest? Do you think it's simply the curiosity of extinct species, sort of the science fiction reality?
One of our goals as we think about Colossal, it's about, for our investors and partners and shareholders, we think about impact, value creation, and inspiration. And we actually weigh it equally with the other three. We hope that the work that we're doing brings attention to the biodiversity crisis that we're in, as well as inspires, you know, little girls and boys to potentially go be a geneticist or biologist because they see like the cool factor of what we're doing. And so while we can look at all of the ecological impacts of the work and the conservation benefit to the work, there it is also cool. I mean, it just is. And that's not lost on us or anyone we talk to. We have moms from all over the world sending us drawings of from their little kids of like, when can I see a mammoth back in the wild? And that's inspiring. Hopefully that inspires them. Hopefully that inspires us, right? And so I do think that humanity has a weird relationship with extinction. And this, the idea that we can undo some of the sins of the past, like with the mammoth and the thylacine and the dodo, that we directly cause their extinctions, I think is really interesting. And so I think there's this kind of like moral opportunity that we have, as well as applying those technologies to stop the rate of biodiversity loss that we have today. I think that's why it sparks that imagination. And then I think that just creates more and more excitement to the synthetic biology field, which I think, like conservation, needs more money and more people focused on it.
Yeah, definitely. You mentioned how a lot of these extinctions are caused by humans. There are going to be governments that are difficult to deal with. There are going to be hunters. There are going to be farmers that might be negative. I guess, how do you prevent bringing these species back and us just basically doing the same thing again?
Well, I think it's really important that this is transparent, collaborative from day one. Our job at Colossal is not to persuade anyone. Our job is to be transparent and educate people on the benefits of what we're doing and, you know, let people make their own decisions. You know, even though we don't have mammoths or thylacines or dodos yet, we are already starting those conversations, right? Like, we're working with Mauritian Wildlife Foundation in Mauritius. We're building another subcommittee in the Arctic right now in the some of the Arctic Circle nations around mammoth and mammoth rewilding. We've established and announced our Tasmanian Tiger Advisory Committee that meets every quarter, right? And so, you know, the rewilding aspects of this and taking into account the public, indigenous people, governments, private landowners, and the public at large, you know, that just takes time. And getting all their feedback and direction takes time. We've tried to be very collaborative in that approach. And, you know, we didn't wait until we had animals to then go try to do that work, right? We're investing that time in those relationships now. And what's incredible is the feedback that we get from governments and some of these private landowners is just incredible. We've had people cry in some of these meetings in Tasmania saying, just thank you so much for doing this. My great grandfather used to tell me stories of the thylacine. And I just got back from New York City, where I was meeting with a bunch of groups here in the United States about animals like buffalo and whatnot that, you know, aren't extinct, but have got to the verge of extinction because of other people's choices. And so it's very interesting to hear those stories and understand the cultural relevance. And, you know, we're finding that more and more people in the areas that we want to rewild the species are the most excited about what we're working on.
I guess there's about 30 million species on the planet currently, and some estimates say that we're losing between 50 and 100 a day, which is horrible and frightening.
What's crazy about that is when we did our first investor deck talking about loss of biodiversity, the stats were we were going to lose up to 10% of biodiversity between now and 2050. Well, that was 2021, and what's crazy is those stats have been revised to be 35 to 50%. And so in 2 years, those numbers, the trend line on that's not great. Anything that we can do to help, and there's not enough money going into conservation. And as you know from your podcast, that like technology and research and development's hard. It's expensive. Like, people don't realize about the, in R&D, research and development, there's a lot of money that goes into R before there's any money that's going into the D of development, right? And sometimes you don't see the fruits of that labor for years. For us, I think that having people that are so focused on the application now of our technologies to conservation is, you know, a real blessing of our company. But I think it's something that the conservation community needs. You know, we almost think of Colossal partly as like a free research and development arm for conservation.
Which is an excellent thing to be doing. Does that kind of weigh heavy a little bit, though, the fact that there's all of this negativity happening and all these species being lost, and you think, well, how much can we do?
I mean, I'm an optimist, right? I believe in the goodness of people. I believe in humanity. So I believe we will be successful in our endeavors as humanity, right? Like, Colossal is not going to repair all ecosystems. Colossal is not going to save every critically endangered species or bring back every species that we had a hand in its extinction, right? And eradication. But I think that we can be one thread in a big tapestry of technologies that can all come together and help solve this problem, right? Like, we are seeing countries now being net negative from a carbon perspective and an energy perspective, right? Like, these are doable things. They just require intentionality.
Each species that you work with has different challenges. How do you address that, I guess?
They all have different challenges, both from a rewilding and conservation perspective, but also from an engineering perspective. And like, when you look at taking off the science hat and putting on more of a engineering hat, when you're building a systems and doing systems design, and you could have a couple of different problems that have a similar process but different flex points, it really does help you design a better system and improve on at least a base system of which you can then iterate from. So for example, we've talked a little bit about the processes for the de-extinction of the mammoth, but at least from our mammalian work, broader than the mammoth. But if you think about it in a couple of ways and oversimplify it, I think you'll start to see the system design of how we're looking at this. The mammoth, the DNA is massively degraded. You know, we need over 60 mammoth genomes to really get where we are today. The editing isn't monumental. I mean, it's more than any other model or non-model organism that's ever done on the planet, but it's not monumental. It's not beyond the scope of human ingenuity, right? And then the gestation is complicated because there's a lot that we still have to learn as humanity around elephant developmental biology, and it's a 22-month gestation. Now let's look at the thylacine, right? We got over a 92% complete genome in our first read of very well-preserved museum specimens. And we have multiple of those, right? Then the editing, given there's 70 million years genetic divergence between its closest living relative to fat-tailed dunner, one of the desiurids in the desiurid family of carnivorous marsupials, it's the size of a mouse. It's not the size of a wolf, right? So there's a lot of editing that has to take place, as well as large DNA synthesis. And then on the far side of gestation, just oversimplifying into these three categories, you know, it's Dunards and marsupials, they do so much of their gestation ex utero, right? So outside of the womb. And so it's a 13 and a half day gestation. So mammoth is like hard, easier, hard. Thylacine is easy, hard, and easy. I mean, none of it's easy. So that's a massive kind of I hope none of our team listens to this because they'll be frustrated at that characterization. But it is an inverse problem set, right? And so the opportunities around innovating around ancient DNA assembly and comparative genomics for mammoth makes the process for the thylacine easier, and vice versa for the editing on from thylacine to mammoth. So that's how we're trying to categorize a de-extinction event, a systems approach, and a species preservation opportunity all together, because we think it helps us build the best system design.
I guess one of the most recent announcements from the company was the documentary series that you're planning. I wonder if you could tell me a bit about that and the reasoning behind it, because it sounds like a really exciting project.
Yeah, I mean, we think that if we're successful, right, chronicling this for science is important. We had a couple hundred production companies, directors, some household names calling us, and we felt like being core to our mission, we really wanted someone that would be truly independent and someone that would also be objective and really document it for science. And I will tell you, we always talk about transparency and having meetings like this and doing podcasts and publishing our results and all of those things. But I'll tell you, there's another layer to transparency once cameras start filming. And if you've seen Chimp Empire, which is critically acclaimed and was nominated for an Emmy and the Oscar award-winning My Octopus Teacher, James and his team are incredible storytellers. They're incredible capturers of nature, and they're also authentic and independent. And so for us, that was really the right, like after our first call with James, we really took another look at considering doing a docuseries, you know, just because we believe it checks a lot of the goals that our company has with being transparent, inspiring people and whatnot. So we were very excited when James showed up with his interest, and we knew that we could have something that was truly special yet independent.
What are the next steps for the company? And while you can't put an exact time on it, when should we start to be expecting to see some tangible results?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. You know, we put one big goal out there of 2028 for our first Mammoth Cabs. We are on track for that. We're very excited about it. That could always slip because science, as you know, is hard. Snake biology is new. This is an interesting and emerging field, but we do think the advancements in AI and other technologies coming online just further validate that timeline, as well as could increase others. I will say that with a 22-month gestation, it's more than likely you would see a species before the mammoth. We're not making any commitments to what that could or couldn't be, but 22 months is, as you know, quite some time. So I think it's highly likely before 2028 we'll see something before mammoth. But as far as the results go, we try to communicate transparently on the web, on social, in our papers. We just announced our induced pluripotent stem cells in elephants, which is really exciting given that no one's ever been able to achieve that. We mostly probably because of P53 and some of the other things that are happening in those cells. But they're also not, obviously not a model, so people haven't studied them as long. Yeah, so as we continue to make updates in our editing efficiencies, our rewilding plans, our impacts to conservation, I think you'll continue to see hopefully iterative progress, not just a quick massive mammoth unveiling.
Yeah, because I guess it's not just the science, as from what you've been saying, it's also the discussions with the countries that it's going to be reintroduced to, and governments, local people. There's a lot to just the science.
There's a lot, so much to it, right? And it's awesome, though, because we are getting to engage with people all over the world from all walks of life. And it's just, it's inspiring to hear their stories and see how our work is impacting them.
Well, that interview could have gone on for many hours, as there are so many questions to ask, and it's such an interesting thing to talk about. I can just imagine the number of people wanting to go to the Arctic to see mammoths if they are indeed reintroduced into the wild. Hopefully it's good news for all of the other species being lost at an alarming rate as well. Don't forget to check out the latest news and articles over at labiotech.eu, and I hope wherever in the world you are, you have a great week ahead. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us next time for another Beyond Biotech.